Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett. Here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today we have on Jan Svenda. Welcome, Jan, to the show.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to have you on. I've actually wanted to have you on for a while. I think what you do is really interesting. So I'm not going to go through your whole resume, but you had this specialization in looking at a lot of these unlisted securities and over-the-counter stocks. And you tend to go to parts of the market that are quite obscure. I find it fascinating. I personally like to do a lot of that stuff, and I've enjoyed some of the stuff that you've written on Seeking Alpha, and so it's really an honor to have you on the show. Maybe for the listeners, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, who you are, what you do, how you got into all the OTC stuff? Just give us a little rundown of who you are, and I'm going to sit back and drink my coffee.
Sure. Well, thanks for the kind words first, Eric. I mean, I really appreciate that coming from you as well. I know that you have been around the space yourself, so it's really nice to hear you say that. So as you mentioned, yeah, I'm for the past 2 years, essentially, I was exclusively focused on the OTC space, so over-the-counter market. And the way I got into there, I really have to kind of start with the start of my investing journey, so to speak. I started to be interested in the stock market, obviously, at during high school, as many of us have. Back then, I was reading MarketWatch.com and listening to Jim Cramer and thinking I was a value investor. But then I got more serious about things when I attended university in the United Kingdom, and I started writing for Seeking Alpha in 2014. And after that, after my time at university, I actually had an internship at an investment bank in London, and I had one year experience in a small equity research firm. So essentially, I was doing equity research there. And after that sell side experience, I kind of understood, where I want to go further, where I want to go next, and what would be my focus. Because the sell side experience kind of gave me a good experience of, what I should be good at, and where could my investing edge be? When I was working at the small research firm, actually, we were doing a lot of large caps, and I just got to understand that I'm not very good at forecasting, what the next step of Amazon will be, or what Netflix show is going to be the next hit. And, DCF models, I mean, don't even, let's not start on DCF models. So I thought,
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. I would have cut you off.
Sure. I'm not sure what the growth of a company is until the very end of the world. So I wasn't very good at that.
And you can't tell me the proper discount rate and the terminal growth rate after.
Yeah.
Let's just say every company grows for 2% a year to infinity. Right?
Yeah. But then, yeah. So that was just mainly the problem I had. And I thought, okay, well, I was naturally drawn to small companies actually to start with. So even back in the days of Seeking Alpha when I started, I usually wrote about small caps, but it was only listed side. And so I thought, okay, well, the smaller companies, I think that's where my focus will be, and also where my kind of edge lies a bit. So when I thought about what I research, I thought, okay, maybe I could be good at reading what other people don't want to read. So it's just a kind of a simple thing. Like, if you give me a 100-page legal document, I'll say, okay, well, that's maybe something that many people wouldn't want to read. I thought, okay, well, if I get through that and I understand the situation, maybe that's the way to acquire kind of an edge. And obviously within the small companies, I mean, it makes a lot of sense because not many people look at that, right? So that's kind of like goes well together.
Yeah, it's me, and four people.
Sorry?
It's like me, you, and four people that look at that stuff. We're gonna have like six downloads on this entire episode.
No, that's the ideal situation, right? That's the ideal setup that you want to have. Like, you want to have exactly as least amount of people looking at stuff, right? But so with that, of course, comes in the OTC space, because I read about this story of Ethanex. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. It was a stock that was researched by Tom Brazil, the asset manager. And are you aware of the story or?
No.
So that story got me into OTC because before that, I kind of, you know, knew it as just the penny stock land. And I thought, okay, well, there's no serious investor investing in this space, right? Why would I look at that? But then I heard about Ethanex and I think for people that are following me, they knew about
it. How do you spell that?
Ethanex.
Yeah, I don't know that. Okay.
Ethanex.
No.
Yeah. So there was
what
a
year? What was this?
Tom.
When was this? What year was this?
Well, the story got out in 2015, if I'm not mistaken, or 14.
Okay.
So it's quite old, but I stumbled upon it maybe 2016 or 17. Yeah. I mean, the this was essentially the beginning of my foray into OTC stocks.
Okay.
And there is an interview with Tom Brazil who did the research and who found the opportunity. And you can find that on I can, you know, whatever, send you a link. We can put it up on the part there. And the beauty of the story is that Ethanex was essentially like a bankruptcy stub. So this was a company that was connected to an ethanol plant. The ethanol plant went bankrupt. Then bankruptcy proceedings were kind of going smoothly. And however, you could still buy the stock. You could still buy the equity, actually. And this sometimes happens if there is a bankruptcy proceedings. You can still buy the equity in the hopes of that you're going to actually get something out of it, out of the equity, right? I mean, you're the most junior holder or, you know, the junior rights to the proceeds of the bankruptcy. But there is a hope that something can come out of it. And actually, Tom Brazil found Ethanex and he started looking into the stub and he said, oh, so there is this bankruptcy proceedings. But if you look at the bankruptcy docket on Pacer, right, if you do the legal research, you actually understand that the only thing that left outstanding is this one lawsuit. And that lawsuit was connected to the company and the company, Ethanex, was suing one of its insiders. I'm not going to go into much detail. It doesn't really matter what exactly happened, but the basis of the lawsuit was that the company was suing one of its insiders and it was suing for about $3 million, right? So if Ethanex wins, they will get $3 million and, there's nothing else left. So essentially, you know, the stock would be worth $3 million or your equity would be worth $3 million. The trick was, of course, that at time when Tom Brazil was looking at it, the stock was trading at around $300,000. Yeah. So, that means, of course, if the lawsuit goes through, you get 10X on the investment because you buy the claim for $300,000 and you get $3 million out of it if the lawsuit is successful, right? If you were to buy the whole thing.
Yeah.
So he understood it. Yeah. Yeah. Does that make sense?
No. Yeah. I think it's, I'm just laughing. I'm smiling over here and I didn't want to start cracking up. I just think it's funny that like your first OTC experience, like what got you into it was dealing with like a litigation stub. Like that's kind of hilarious.
Yeah, I mean that's what like it was one of that's how it all started with the obscurity and then just kind of like went even more obscure.
It reminds me of when I was in college and I started getting into special situations. Like I thought that was like a cool thing. So the very first thing I did was like some liquidation arbitrage and it was just like that was my first thing.
Cool, perfect. Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's certainly, you know, certainly.
So you're
cool
talking my language
for some people. Yeah. So essentially, he found the situation. He understood what is happening, and he started buying up stock. He started buying up quite a bit. Now, obviously, he bought what he could on the public market, essentially through your broker. But he went.
You can't buy that much. It was $300,000 market cap. So okay.
Yeah, but the funny thing was, I mean, obviously, I mean, the total value of the investment, like,
was it like,
I
was mean, like a $10,000 investment,
is limited, but yeah, but I mean, I think that his stake was about 50,000 at the end. So
wow, okay,
you know, it's still very meaningful. The funny thing he did was that he not only went through his broker to buy shares, but he actually called up the board of directors and he started actually asking them if they don't want to sell him his shares, their shares, and actually some of them agreed to it. Because Why? They thought, oh, well, it's not really worth anything. It's kind of like disconnected stock to the lawsuit. I don't want to be involved in that. And actually, some of the insiders themselves that were not connected to the lawsuit sold their shares.
And they didn't the insiders didn't see the value in that? That's weird to me.
Yeah, that I think that most, like what he wrote in the interview was that the insiders were actually not, they were not connected to the stock at all, most of the, because it was way past the bankruptcy, it was 5-6 years ago. And also they just didn't want to be connected to it. They thought, oh, it's this, because the one of the insiders, the lawsuit was about insider trading and fraud. Okay. So, it has a bad connotation, so to speak. That's what he wrote in the interview. Well.
Do you have a link to that interview that I could post when this
is published? Sure. I can send that afterwards. Yeah. I think it's hilarious. So anyways, what happened was that they won the lawsuit and they got the proceeds. And I will send the link and you have all the right the right data. But I think he made some sort of 10x return. I'm not super sure about that.
You can make a lot of money in that space. It could be tough though if you don't know. I think what the situation that you point out is maybe a little bit more straightforward, but. A lot of these litigations are incredibly difficult to understand.
Yeah, I think.
And if you're wrong, you can be really screwed.
Exactly, and before we talked, I mentioned Premier Exhibitions is just one of the examples where it can go wrong. But yeah, I think that for me, what Athenex was really, what it signaled is that OTC space can actually be super interesting. And for me, it made a lot of sense to start looking for a stock like Athenex. I still haven't found one on my 10Xer from a legal situation, but hopefully one day. But for me, it made a lot of sense because actually I could, decrease my reliance on forecasting, future. And obviously you always forecast future if you go long, right? You always forecast, you always rely on some sort of forecast. But here in Athenex, you didn't really have to forecast how the U.S. economy is going to do or what the German PMI is going to be. You only cared about the lawsuit. And maybe that's complex, but, you can do your research, you can do your homework, and you can say, okay, well, the probability, is much more clearer than just, buying Amazon. So for me, that was like, oh, my God, it's not only you can make, interesting amounts of money, but the research just makes a lot of sense compared to what I was doing previously. So that was kind of my initial interest in OTC, and then I went all in, and I thought, well, that's the space that I'm going to be for a while.
Interesting. Then what had you start deciding to build this OTC manual, almost like a modern day Walker's manual?
Yeah. So once I started looking in the OTC space, I understood that. There is a place for a newsletter. There is a place for newsletter that would provide research to people that are interested in the space because, it's not really a well-known space and the community is relatively small and there are not that many people, posting anything publicly. There are a couple of blogs, certainly, and you had Dan Schum on, a couple of months ago. So certainly that there are some examples of that, but I thought, okay, well, I'm interested in running a newsletter. So I start doing that, and there were two main parts of the newsletter. The first part was just your regular long ideas. So obviously I researched stocks that I thought were investment opportunities and wrote up reports on them. In total, it was like 76 long ideas in the year and a half I was doing the newsletter. That includes like 20 community banks, like a portfolio of banks, because I was not super interested in covering all the community banks. So I just kind of picked one portfolio and did that. So that was one part, just long ideas. And then the second part was a database, actually, because the OTC space is one big problem. Like if you start looking at it and if you are not, you're not completely, scared of Athenex and the situations that are in the OTC land, you start looking at it and you see that there's like 6,000, 7,000 stocks. And a lot of them are just complete crapshoots. So, you know, a lot of them don't make any sense. I mean, a lot of them are still pump and dumps. I mean, the OTC land is still full of that. So you run into a problem where, okay, it's quite hard to find actual stocks that, you know, have an operating business, or there is that legal situation that could be, you know, profitable and so on and so forth. So I thought, okay, well, what I could provide is essentially build a database of meaningful companies so that investors don't waste time looking at the OTC space and don't know where to start. So the database I built has like over 400 stocks inside, and that's, I think, a good portion of the OTC market, which is meaningful and which people should know about at the very least, I think. So that was the second part, the database. And I wrote reports about the companies in the database as well. So I not only wrote about long ideas, but I wrote about stocks in the database. And the OTC manual that you mentioned, that's you can kind of find samples of that on my website. That's a culmination of that. So I essentially took all the research and put it into one compilation, and that's the OTC manual that I created, which has all of the research and has all the reports about the stocks in the database.
And how often are you updating this?
So I actually compiled it late last year. So I haven't updated it yet because I believe that a lot of the info is still very much up to date. And, you know, if you look at it, there are obviously, you know, the situation with every stock is changing from day to day. But, you know, the bulk of the information is actually valid. And also, I mean, there is a lot of OTC stocks that are meaningful, but not that many that have been written about and, you know, in public. And also, you know, even if they were, maybe it was like 10 years ago or 5 years ago, or, you know, Nate Tobik or Dave Waters wrote about them on their blogs, right? But that's like 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So so even if they are, if there are some reports about it, I think that a lot of it is fresh and that the information is actually still valid.
And you're doing all this yourself? Like, you don't get help?
No. I mean, the database, I did it myself. I mean, I ran through the old good strategy of going A to Z in the OTC space, essentially going one by one.
I was just
going
to ask you, have you looked through every single OTC stock at least once?
I did at least once. So I essentially ran through all the stocks are US listed. US companies. So I'm not, like, the OTC market is actually far larger than the 6,000, 7,000 stocks, but you have the foreign stocks, but it's not really that interesting to look at the stocks there, because you can just go to the original exchange, like Canada, and just search there. So I did go through the US companies in the OTC space. Yeah.
Do you do international stuff too, or is it just United States?
Yeah, I mean, I started with the US. I think that there's a huge advantage in researching US companies, and that's really the data that's available. You know, going to the very detail of like incorporation, you know, you can pull up a certificate of incorporation for a company in the US, and doing that, in Europe, it's actually quite hard.
Is there a European equivalent to the OTC?
There is one called AIM in London, okay. Alternative Investment Market, but actually that's another level of obscurity and craziness. There are some interesting stocks out there, and actually I can point to one, for example, which is Bank of Belize, which is actually double listed on the OTC as well. But a lot of that is really exotic. Like, you have like Zimbabwe stocks, like African stocks, mining stocks. And, you know, a lot of them is just, I think it's kind of similar to the OTC space in that there's a lot of crap out there that doesn't really make much sense.
To invest in those spaces, do you need to have like a specialized broker? I mean, would you need like 20 different brokerage accounts to get access to these exchanges, or?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly helps to have different accounts. I mean, myself, I have TradeStation, which have been really good, actually, in providing access to the OTC stock. So they trade, you know, 99% of what I wanted to own. There are a couple of brokers out there that really provide a good access to that. I know that Dan Chu mentioned Schwab, but that's for U.S. residents. But I'm located in Europe, so I have to go through the international ones. Interactive Brokers, actually.
I couldn't. Kind of, well, so Interactive Brokers is a mixed bag, because A lot of stuff you can buy with them, but then occasionally, I'll find something and they don't trade it. Like there was a situation on I don't remember what it stands for, the AIM exchange in London. What does that stand for, by the way?
Alternative Investment Market.
Okay, I had no idea what it stood for. And there was a security on there that I actually wanted to buy, and I wasn't able to buy it through Interactive Brokers, which I was a little frustrated with.
They've generally been good, but that was the one thing
I can actually remember where I wasn't able to buy something.
I was about to say, I mean, Interactive Brokers, surprisingly, is not that great for OTC. I mean, certainly, you know, a really professional broker, but actually, for some of the stocks, they don't allow you to buy that. I mean, funnily enough, like, I am located in Czech Republic, and my Czech broker, who's like this small company that I have a small account with, I mean, some of the stock I could buy through my Czech broker, but not through Interactive Brokers. So that was kind of funny. So I have a couple of accounts, but TradeStation has been actually very good in the access to OTC space.
How does it work with market makers doing OTC stuff? Do you know anything about that?
Well, the OTC market, essentially, you know, I think for people that are not super aware of how the structure works, is that, you know, you don't have any central exchange. Mm-hmm. So back in the days where it was super interesting to do the OTC space, you would actually have to really know the broker, go to the broker, ask if they have some people that are trading in the stock, and you would have to really know the broker and connect it there, because there is no central exchange, right? So you don't go to one place to trade all the stocks, but you have to go to these individual brokers which have access to people that are trading in the stock. So back in the day, you would really have to physically go to the broker or call them up and try to get someone to buy or sell the stock that you wanted to have positioned or you wanted to sell. And
you,
so that's
do
kind
you,
of like
do you know thing. Any books or things like I feel like those kinds of stories would be fascinating to hear firsthand, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't stumbled upon a book, but I know that some of the guys that I know in the OTC space, they've been doing that. They've actually, like, you know, in the 80s or 90s, I mean, they own some of the OTC stocks that are still, you know, still out there. And, I mean, they have been really doing this kind of thing where they had to go, you know, physically to the broker, and they would have to do through that. But so I don't know any books, but I think
it's fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So explain how it works today. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So essentially, that was the situation until the internet arrived. And when the internet arrived, OTCmarkets.com popped up. I mean, the company, and they created this ATS structure, which is essentially connecting the brokers. So essentially, it's not there's a central exchange, but the brokers nowadays are connected. So I don't have to know the broker, or I don't have to know the person that is doing the market, so to speak, in the stock. But I can just send out an order, and the order will go around the OTC market, will go around to the individual brokers, and whoever, you know, going to accept the ask, then or the sorry my bid, then you know, they will execute the trade. So essentially, nowadays it's almost the same, or it has the same feel as the listed market now.
Yeah, because I mean, it feels like NASDAQ with low liquidity almost.
Yeah. I mean, certainly there's no hurdle in terms of trading in the OTC space. Obviously, I have to preface that. I mean, like, I think the OTC space has a lot of individual risk, so I don't want to sound as if it is the listed market and is as if there is, you know, business as usual. I think that there's a lot of inherently peculiar risk that connected to the OTC market, but it has the same feeling in terms of at least the trading.
Now, for someone who has way too much time on their hands, who actually wants to start doing this themselves, I almost feel like you're going to explain how this happens and how you actually look for these companies themselves. And maybe more than half these people listening will be like, oh, my God, I would never want to do that. But for the people that are a little bit more spirited, have a little bit more free time on their hands, if they want to start getting into you know, researching some of these obscure companies, where would they even start?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, you mentioned a good point where you say, you know, some people wouldn't want to go through it. And that's the nature of the
There's
opportunity.
There's more than some people. I mean, look, if you're my dad's a physician, right? And he has an investment portfolio, but like he does not have the time to start like manually looking through like over the counter securities. It'd be ridiculous.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that's a good point. But generally, like even if you are an asset manager or an investor, or you want to get more into it, I think that for a lot of people, it would just be a lot of time, and they would say, okay, well, I don't want to spend time doing that. But that's why the opportunities exist there.
Yeah, and also right? if you're a large firm, it's a lot of the stuff that doesn't even move the needle. It's a waste of time.
Of course. I mean, there's that natural limit on volume as well. Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, if you want to punish yourself through looking at OTC, then you can start. I think the best way is to do the manual thing, because this is the strategy that will make you will make sure that you're not missing anything, or at least you're not going to miss something obvious, or obvious in the sense that if you look at it, you'll understand it. Because I think that time and time again, I found that even seasoned OTC investors just didn't know about some of the companies that, pop up in the OTC land if you go through it manually. And by manually, I mean you go to OTCmarkets.com, and there is this screener that they have on there, and the screener doesn't have any fundamental data. So essentially, you can't screen for any fundamental data on the OTC space. There are some companies that actually file with SEC, so you can screen them because, the screeners, professional screeners would have them there. And actually Bloomberg, for example, have like some fundamental data that is not even in some screeners. So there are screeners out there that could help you, but the best way is to manual, and essentially that's the manual way, and that is going through the OTCmarkets.com screener. And you essentially download the list of the U.S. companies, and you go one by one. And, it takes about 2-3 minutes to understand what the situation could be there, right? So, I mean, a lot of times the companies don't have any operating business. A lot of times it's just shell, or a lot of times it's just that, like, these insanely overvalued companies that just don't make any sense. I mean, one example for every is, like, this Bigfoot stock. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I actually am aware of it, but please share the story.
So that's probably, like, creme de la creme of obscurity.
It's hilarious.
I think that's probably that's still number one in terms of the most obscure stock that I came across. But essentially,
tell the story about this. This is great.
Yeah. So I mean, it's a company which was founded by this guy who is interested in Bigfoot, but not interested in a sense like, oh, let's do some souvenirs or whatever, and let's do some amusement center connected to Bigfoot. No, but he really believes in Bigfoot, so he really believes he exists, or the mythical creature exists. And he set up a company where the ultimate goal of the company is to find Bigfoot. Right? That's the sole reason for the company. So they don't care really about selling anything to you as a consumer. No, they want to find Bigfoot, and they believe it's a venture that you should invest in. And actually, funnily enough, for some odd reasons regarding trading, it was actually worth billions of dollars, the market cap of the company in the very initial stages, because it was just a couple of trades at like some ridiculous prices, and it valued the company at like billions of dollars.
Is there volume in that stock?
Yeah. Surprisingly, I mean, I don't know who's interested in buying that, but
like,
if you look
who the fuck's trading that?
Exactly, it's BGFT. BGFT. That's the ticker. And right now, it's only about a million market cap, actually.
Jesus.
But it's trading like a fraction of a cent or something. But yeah, the last trade was yesterday, so somebody bought some. But yeah, like that's the whole.
I wonder how
the stock.
Yeah. I also wonder something I've wondered about is, the average person isn't a freak like us that's spending all this time on the OTC markets. Who do you think is discovering some of these just beyond obscure companies? Do you think there's like newsletters with pump and dump schemes, or where do you think people are getting these tickers from?
Yeah, I think I think that a lot of the stocks that are not meaningful, I think, are covered by the pump and dump newsletter. There's still a lot of them around, and if you look at some authors on Seeking Alpha, there's a lot of them actually that cover the pump and dumps and say, okay, short this because it just doesn't make any sense. So even in 2019, you know, you have little Jordan Belforts running around and trying to push some stocks in the OTC land. So, yeah, probably that would be one reason. The other one, I just, you know, sometimes you don't know. I mean, sometimes you don't know. And I think that, yeah, sometimes people just don't know what they're buying, I think, a lot of times in the OTC space.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So, So, I mean, if you buy actually the company, you're buying not only the person that is trying to find the Bigfoot, but you're actually buying a skeleton skeleton that they believe is a skeleton of a Bigfoot. So you actually own something. So yeah, it's just, well, that's one of the most hilarious stocks. But so you go through that, and you know, you go through, you stumble upon the ticker BGFT. That's going to be like B if you go A to Z, right? So it's going to be like, you know, a couple of hours in, you will stumble upon that, and you quickly understand, okay, that's not something that's meaningful, and you within 2 minutes. Yeah.
Do you think some of these tickers are forms of money laundering? The reason I ask you this is you know, occasionally there'll be a company, right, and you'll find it on OTC. There's nothing about it. If you Google the name of the company, nothing shows up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except for an OTC thing saying this company exists. But other than that, there's no record of that company, address, the phone number doesn't work. And you got to wonder, and if it's right, and if you're Googling it and there's no newsletter that pops up or anything, sometimes I wonder, well, what does this even exist for?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think a lot of times it's just discarded shells. So, you know, I think a lot of times the OTC companies go bankrupt or they just go out of business. And I think a lot of companies or the entities that are out there, you know, can be shells, essentially, you know, companies that have been on operating business, but, you know, are not anymore. And, you know, who knows who owns them?
They still trade. That's what's weird about it.
Yeah, I mean, I you know what? I think that's a good question. I mean, I think that I never thought about like money laundering as being, you know,
it actually kind of freaks me out when I run into it like several times a year. It's not like a one time ever in my life.
It happens enough
where it's like, this is a little strange.
Exactly. Yeah, and exactly. I mean, and there's a lot of stories that I know about, you know, where the stock was really used for some shady stuff. That was very clear. So I think that, you know, again, the OTC land has specific risks.
Like what? You can't just say skip over.
Yeah, for sure. So there was, it was a classic pump and dump scheme where actually it was a Czech company. A company from Czech Republic. Yeah.
Got it.
And so these guys had assigned a letter of intent with the Kazakhstan company or from Uzbekistan or somewhere like that, a letter of intent to build like a hydroelectric dam in the country, in Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan, I'm not sure which one was it. And these guys have not done any sort of business before, you know, in that regard, like in you know, alternative energy or something like that. And they listed a company, or they actually reverse merged a company into an OTC shell. So they essentially pick an OTC entity and they put their own business inside of that through reverse merger. That's kind of like a process that that goes through that. And it was obvious that they just wanted to pump the stock, because they had this letter of intent that they signed, and people would got to know about the letter of intent, and then they would say, oh, wow, they have this big project, ahead of themselves, so let's buy the stock and let's see where it goes. But actually, like, you know, a month after, it was obvious that the letter of intent is just that, you know, that the project is not going to go through. And actually, in Czech Republic, it was kind of a scandal because the president was involved in that a bit as well. So actually, like, it was very obvious that this is, why on earth would you want to reverse merge an entity into the OTC land when you're dealing with this kind of stuff that just doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, economically, it doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, if you have a company and you need financing in Europe, you don't go to the OTC land, or that just doesn't make any sense. So there are a couple of examples like that where you can really find some odd stuff going on. And I think that that's something that people need to understand also, that the ODC space, you know, it can be risky if, you know, if you're not going to spend enough time researching the company. I think it's easy to look at the company and say, that's some shady stuff. But, you know, that's really important for you to understand, like, okay, you know, you need to do the research.
Yeah. So now if someone doesn't want to do that kind of research, because what, there's what, like maybe 6,000-7,000 OTC stocks right now?
Yeah.
Something like
that? Yeah.
So if someone doesn't want to be doing that manually, are there other services like yours, or are you really the only guy in town?
There is Oddball Stock Newsletter, which is sort of similar, but they only do like kind of long ideas. So they kind of look at the companies and they write research reports about it. But in terms of, I think the volume of the stocks that I covered, I think that I'm the most recent guy that tried doing this. Nate Tobin himself, actually, from Oddball Stocks, he tried doing something similar in 2012, I believe. He did a similar kind of a database, but it didn't really go anywhere. And, of course, before that was the Walker's Manual. I mean, the legend of the ODC investor, right? So a book where you would essentially have companies that are meaningful and are quite interesting. And you would have fundamental data connected to it as well, which is in my database as well.
So how are you succeeding where some of these other guys weren't able to do it? Because as you said, there's not a big market for this.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of producing the database, that's not too hard. I mean, it's hard in terms of doing the manual research and then maintaining the database. But I mean, that part is not that hard. As you say, of course, marketing is one thing, but I believe that the OTC community is relatively closely knit, so you know they know about stuff that is happening, and I think that helps in regards to the database. Yeah,
interesting.
And I mean, the Walker's Manual was essentially a book. They sold it as a book, which is a similar thing to what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's interesting that Walker's never became like an online database, like similar to what you're doing.
Yeah, I know the guys that own the trademark and the previous issues, because they had a newsletter as well connected to
Manual. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's still sort of alive, but I'm not sure what is happening there. I know that they didn't do any new versions, but it's still sort of alive.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
But there is, it's not like new version or anything. I just know that there is the data somewhere, and you can go through the past articles and stuff like that.
I've never even seen this online, that they had newsletters.
Yeah, so that was like it was like 13, 15 years ago that they did the newsletter. So it was kind of like after the book, I believe.
Okay.
And but it's not public anymore. I mean, I haven't seen anything or anything like that. I just know that they did that. But so that's out there. So yeah, it's I mean, not many people, I mean, that have been doing the same thing. Yeah.
So for people that don't want to do all this legwork, where can people find out about the manual, read a little bit about it, contact you if they have any questions? What's the best way to do that?
Yeah, so that would be through the aforementioned website. So you can go to jansvenda.com and you can learn about the ODC manual. You can find samples of that. You can find my email. So if you have any questions, feel free to reach out, and the website will have, you know, most of the information that you will need, and you will find some examples of stocks that are also included in the OTC manual.
Okay, great. And I'll make sure to put some links on erichlein.com for the podcast notes as well.
Perfect. Thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure. All right. Anything else you want to add before we wrap this up?
Yeah. So, I think that when talking about the OTC space, I think that a lot of listeners might be either super scared or super interested when I talk to OTC. When I talk about OTC to a lot of people, they kind of say, okay, well, that's super interested or super scary or weird. But I hope that, listeners kind of got a different view of the market. And I hope that they will take away that the market is actually available and that there are investment opportunities that are worth looking at. And I think for people that have the time or are interested in the stock market, I think just looking at some of the companies in the OTC space can be beneficial, even in the research process, connected to listed stocks. So I think that, since For example, looking at Ethnex, you can understand how, you know, legal situations work and so on and so forth, because these are so such a small opportunity and such a small companies, you know, you can really understand the situation quite well. And you can take away some learning points on that and apply that on the listed side, on this listed side as well. So that's kind of like my closing statement right here.
All right. Very good. Well, hey, this was a pleasure having you on, and hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks a lot again.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.